Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the show about the story behind the story. Today we are joined by a very special guest, a close friend of mine, somebody I consider family, Michael Blowen. Michael is the founder of Old Friends Farm, which most people know that. What people may not know is that Michael and Diane Blowen had three other careers before that, going back to being with the Boston Globe, but even prior to that, a professor at Emerson College. So, Michael, welcome to the show. Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. It was great. Congratulations on the show, and I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. And it's really exciting to have you on the show. I mean, we've always been really close, and I really appreciate everything you do, not just for me, but for the industry in general. So what I'd like to do, because obviously people know about Old Friends. We talk about Old Friends on this show every week. We basically support two foundations on this show, oldfriendsequine.org. If anybody is not familiar with it, take a moment, look at their website. If you're anywhere near Lexington, Kentucky, it's the number one rated attraction on TripAdvisor in the Lexington area. You owe it to yourself to go, and it's really the only place you can get face-to-face with a Kentucky Derby winner. The other foundation that we support here is No Fallen Heroes. So No Fallen Heroes was founded by a Top Gun pilot, Matt Wiz Buckley, good friend of the show, and they are one of the few foundations that helps not only military but first responders. So those being the two things that we support here, Michael Blowen, our guest today, is the founder of Old Friends. And, people know a lot about that. What they may not realize is where you started. So take us back. You grew up in Connecticut. What part of Connecticut was it?
It was Milltown, Thompsonville, Connecticut, in northern Connecticut, just over the border from Springfield, Massachusetts, and right on the Connecticut River. And it was a mill town. We had the largest, at the time, had the largest carpet mill in the world, and grew up kind of like, working class kid, working class family. Yeah. And then I ended up going to school in Boston. I loved the Red Sox, so I wanted to go someplace that was near Fenway Park. I went to Boston University and then graduate school at Emerson College. And after that,
and you taught at Emerson College, correct?
Yes, until they came to their senses and denied me tenure.
But I said, before that happened, tell us a little bit about that, because you had a really interesting career there where, you were teaching classes. I'll let you tell the story, but, you had a really interesting approach where you brought in people from old Hollywood. And tell us a little bit about the classes and a little bit about some of your students that probably a lot of our listeners know.
Well, what was very interesting is Emerson was a small liberal arts school in Boston that specialized in acting and performing. And I got a lot of kids in my class and pupils, and Jay Leno went there, and Henry Winkler. It was a really great time. It was a good time to be a teacher there. It's a good time to be in Boston. After that, I had the opportunity, along with my friend Gary Grossman, wonderful guy, and I got to teach a summer school session at Boston University, and it was about film. It was a very general course. It was a 6-week course, 5 days a week, and it was in 3 hours a day. And I, in a moment of lucidity, I turned to Gary and I said, Gary, I don't know about you, I said, but I can tell him everything I know about filmmaking in an hour and a half. What are we going to go do for the rest of the summer? And we started thinking about that, and a friend of ours named Deke Rossell, who was the former editor of one of the alternative weeklies in Boston, had just gotten a job as a publicity guy and marketing guy for the Directors Guild of America. And we decided that since we couldn't really sustain ourselves, and frankly, only about five or six people had signed up for the course anyway, we got the head of the department to send us out to California. I'd never been to Hollywood in my life. We stayed in the Chateau Marmont hotel, which was then just a dump heap. It was a terrible, terrible, ugly hotel. And a few weeks after we left, that's where John Belushi died, in the Chateau Marmont hotel. Anyway, it's very, very nice now, and I can't afford to stay there. But we went out there, and the proposal we'd made to Deke Rossel was we wanted to find some director out there who wasn't doing anything that could come help us teach this course, and maybe we'd attract a little bit more interest, and the whole burden wouldn't fall on Gary and I to just show 16mm movies all summer. And so we went out there, and it was the response from the older directors was just stunning. But we come back, and
they loved the idea.
They loved the idea because it's a real parallel, frankly, to the horses. Because once you couldn't make money anymore, they were just disposed of. And the same things with the horses that we have now. We have these great horses that marvelous career, some of whom are in the Hall of Fame. and it was the same thing with these old directors. Nobody was paying any attention to them. They were just basically sitting around. So by the time it was
done, Hollywood's always been like that.
Yeah, that's right. And they were older, and you know, when you get older, you know, I know the feeling really strongly now, because now I'm at the age that they were when they came to the school. So I thought if we could just get one of them, we'd be all set. Well, it was they were just really, really grateful that we knew that what they did, and that we appreciated it, and we appreciated the contribution to the history of the motion picture. So, the first one to come on board was Edward Dimitrik, who did, wow, you know, Murder My Sweet. He did the Caine Mutiny. He did all kinds of really, really good pictures. A great director. And he was blacklisted as one of the Hollywood 10 when they had the big scandal about whether they were communists in the movie business.
Yeah, the McCarthy hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is horrible. They even went after Lucille Ball with that.
They went after everybody. John Huston. They went after my friend Julius Epstein, who wrote Casablanca and some other things. They found communists under every rock, and it was only ridiculous. It's ridiculous now. It seems ridiculous, but in those days it was dead serious. And the people who ran the studios were deadly afraid that one of their stars would be called a communist and they'd lose tons of money.
Oh, yeah, it ended careers. There was guys that never worked again after that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really were innocent. I mean, they went on later to prove that those people didn't have anything to do with that.
Of course not. It was all manufactured by a demagogue. So Edward Dimitrik climbed on board, and then we started to fulfill our other obligations to interview other people, but we were playing with a pretty good hand, knowing we already had him in. Well, by the time the whole thing was done, Edward Dimitrik taught the first week. The second week was taught by Ruben Mamoulian, who is a terrific director. He did Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He did the first Technicolor picture, Becky Sharp. I think he directed almost all of Eugene O'Neill's plays on Broadway. So the first week was Dimitrik. The second week was Mamoulian. Then King Vidor, who directed his first film, I think, about 1923, and his last film in 1957, one of the greatest and most underrated film directors ever. His films included what I consider to be the greatest silent film, which is The Big Parade, and a World War I drama, silent movie, and all the way up to The Fountainhead and some other films that he did in the 50s. He was terrific, and he had such a good time that he stayed over another week at his own expense and he team taught the course with Frank Capra, who of course just the old maraschino cherry on top of the old sundae. He was fabulous. And the other thing that I learned by listening to all these old guys is that because they're not interested anymore in, or they're not being invited anymore to generate income for the studios, the chances of them telling you the truth were much greater. And so you really got the real stories. And when people found out who was going to be teaching this course, the enrollment went from five or six, to over 300. And we had to have it in the theater. And it was just great. And all Gary and I had to do was thread the projector and let them go. It was the easiest money I ever made in my life. And it was so much fun. I would have paid to Boston University to allow me to teach it. But it was a lot of fun.
Did Julie come and teach one of them?
What's that?
Did Julius Epstein come and teach one of them?
No, he didn't. I didn't know Julie at that time.
Oh, you didn't know him at that time. Okay.
Yeah, that came later because coming out of that, I started to do some interviews with some directors and things and sell them. I did an interview with Elia Kazan when The Last Tycoon came out. Of course, Elia Kazan was another one that was involved in The Blacklist. And he was another one who made, he directed almost all of Tennessee Williams, plays that were made into films, Streetcar Named Desire. And he was great. And I did an interview with him and sold it for $100.
The
local alternative weekly, and then there were so many movies coming out, and the Globe needed a second string movie critic to come and pick up the slack and do the see the movies and review the movies that the main critic, the first string critic, didn't want to see. So they called me, and I started doing that on a freelance basis. And a few years later, they made me quasi legitimate.
The Globe, they approached you. So that was really how you got to the Boston Globe, was they approached you.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah,
We're joined by Michael Blowen, old friends farm and former Boston Globe movie critic, talking about Hollywood and his career. So you're at Emerson. You've put this together with all the directors and everything, which is, it's a book in itself. You could write a book about that class.
Yeah,
I mean it was amazing to have that many people go through that room with that much experience from Hollywood.
Yeah.
It had to be just surreal.
Well, as you know, as a friend of mine, I only like to do things that are fun. that was a lot of fun.
You do it very well.
Very little work and a lot of fun is my motto.
But you have a gift of being able to put it together and let people do what they do, and that's a perfect example.
Well, I wanted to be a movie director originally, and I actually got I got hired to make a movie in Ireland.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I wrote the script. It was about two American folk singers. One was a native Irishman, and the other was an Irish American. And they go back to Ireland, and I wanted to do it. It was kind of like an interesting St. Patrick's Day special. The Irish Americans saw everything romantically, and so we had these romantic things about how beautiful Ireland is, et cetera. And the other guy, the Irishman, of course, was much more cynical, and we had some other stuff in there that wasn't as complimentary to old sod. and made that movie and through a wild, crazy series of circumstances, I got a print of it into the hands of the great producer, director, Otto Preminger.
Wow.
And I brought it down to New York, and I left it off with him, and he told me to come back later at his house, his townhouse in Manhattan, and pick up the movie. So I went off and went around New York, and then I came back at 6:30 at night, and I rang Otto Preminger's doorbell, and the butler answered, and Otto came out and goes, "Mr. Blowen, thank you for coming." I said, "Okay, Mr. Preminger, thank you for looking at my movie." And he goes, "You know, He says, I think that's the worst movie I ever saw in my life.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I said, really? He goes, yeah. He says, one of the reasons I wanted to come down and talk to you rather than just hand it off is I was very curious about what exactly you had in mind. So now it's funny. It wasn't that funny then. But it was very good career advice because I would have been, I would have made probably a very poor movie director. And my life ended up the way it had.
Then, what was it that led you to full time, or was it just kind of natural attrition as you kept getting busier and doing more that they pulled you in?
Well, you know, the Globe was expanding too. The Globe was just a tremendous newspaper. And I don't want to sound too nostalgic about all this, but, you know, my wife, Diane White, was a great columnist there.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to touch on that.
You know, Ellen Goodman and Mike Barnicle. And then the sports section, you know, Peter Gammons was covering baseball and Bob Ryan was covering the NBA and Bud Collins was covering tennis. And
to put it in perspective for our listeners, especially our younger listeners, you know, this is pre-internet. So when you're talking about the Boston Globe at that time, you know, it was kind of one of the three points of the triangle, in my opinion. You had the LA Times, New York Times, and Boston Globe. So, yeah, it was huge.
Yeah, it was a great time. And you know, when I first started, you know, I was an academic and I was young. And I was very snobby about the movies. And I taught courses in Ingmar Bergman and Federico Fellini. Now the Globe sending me out to review movies called The Hills Have Eyes and The Incredible Melting Man and Ice Castles and all this drivel. And that was totally beneath me. But that was very important too, because by the time I started to be able to review the better movies, I had a really, really good foundation in trash. I mean, it's a good place to start.
Made you appreciate it a little bit more.
Yes. And
tell us a little bit about what that was like, because I think people don't realize that at this time, you didn't just send somebody an email. You would actually get on the plane or train and go out to Hollywood and meet with the directors and meet with the actors and spend time with them.
Yeah. Well, it was different, as you point out. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was the second screen critic, I'd complain all the time to my editor that I needed to see some decent movies because I was going nuts, just looking at the same stuff. And I was getting really good feedback from readers and feedback from other editors and things, and I knew that I could do it, but I was still a second circuit. So I found out that John Huston was coming to town to promote his autobiography, and I went to my editor and I said, look, I promise you I won't complain about anything for a year. You can send me to the Ice Capades. I'll do whatever you want. but I really want to interview John Huston. If you let me interview John Huston and let me set that up, I promise I won't complain for a year. So she agreed quickly, almost too quickly. But anyway, so I set up this interview to talk to John Huston. It was about 3 weeks away from his scheduled visit. And in those days, of course, there's no VHS. There's no, you know, there's no home movies or anything. I had to go to the Boston Public Library, but it was great. I went to the Boston Public Library where they had a huge collection of 16-millimeter prints, and I watched all these great old John Huston movies, you know, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, you know, the African Queen, The Maltese Falcon, and I could go on and on. But anyway, all these great movies. So I was really prepared. So I made arrangements with the publisher to show up on – I was going to spend the day with him instead of just sitting down in a room for an hour and talking to him. And so I was all excited. And they said, okay, show up at 7 o'clock on Monday morning at the Ritz Hotel, just dial up his room and off you go. I said, fine. So Monday morning, 7 o'clock on the dot, I dial up his room and he answers the phone. And I told him who I was, Michael Blow, Boston Globe. I've come to spend the day with you, Mr. Houston. And there's a pause, and he goes, well, Michael, he says, I don't see anything about it on my paper. I go, oh, okay. He said, but why don't you come up and we'll work it out? I said, okay. So I go up to his room. He answers the door. He's still in his pajamas. And he said, why don't you have a seat? I've called up for some coffee and muffins. Here's my itinerary. You look at it, see what you can find. So I get the itinerary, and it has nothing about me on this Monday. Nothing. And I turn it out on the page, and on Tuesday, I'm scheduled to spend the day with him on Tuesday. So according to the itinerary, I showed up a day early and woke him up. And now I want to do what horses do when they're scared. They just want to run away.
Turn and run.
I just wanted to head for the elevator, but I didn't. He came back out. He says, what'd you find? And I said, well, I really apologize. I said, I guess I wasn't supposed to come till tomorrow. He goes, well, why don't you sit there and we'll get the coffee. You'll be here any minute. We'll talk. And we started talking a little, and then he noticed that I had a racing form sticking out of my back pocket. And he looks at me and he goes, is that a racing form? I go, yeah. He says, they have racing here? Yeah. They have a racetrack, thoroughbred racetrack. Yeah. Are they racing today? I said, yeah. Oh, okay. Now, he says, don't go anywhere. I'll be back. I'm going. And he goes in the other room, and he comes back about 15 minutes later. He says, I've rearranged everything. Well, I'm doing all my interviews in the morning. We're going to go to the track this afternoon. And we went to the track both days that he was there. We became great friends. He gave me what I think is one of the great books ever about horse racing, a book called Laughing in the Hills by Bill Barish, that is set at the old Golden Gate Fields up in San Francisco. And we became really, really good friends.
And he's one of my favorites as well. I mean, his movies to me are like amazing.
Yeah, he was my godfather. If anybody didn't want to do an interview or didn't want to do something, I could call him up and he would make the phone call. And it's funny how it works out, because that's how I got to meet Jack Nicholson and develop a relationship with him. And the reason is because they were promoting a really funny mafia comedy called Pritzi's Honor. And Jack was in it with Angelica Houston. And so it's a really funny movie. And John directed it. And after it came out, Jack was never did television. And he wanted to do it. He promised to do an interview with the New York Times, the LA Times. And everybody else had to put their name in a hat. Scott, you know, Ebert and Siskel and Washington, but everybody else, all of us. And Jack got the list and he gave it to John, and John told him he should talk to me. And that's how that whole thing happened, just because of John. And,
I'm eternally grateful. Yeah, and Jack ended up being really good friends. You'd go to games.
We don't see each other much anymore, but I asked him once. I said to him, why are we friends? I said, you know, we don't see each other. We don't go anywhere. You know, we go to a ball game or something, or, you know, get together for lunch or dinner or something, or, you know, nothing a lot. I said, why are we still friends after all these years? And he said to me, it's because you never acted as a go-between.
Yeah.
You're the only friend I've ever had who never asked me for something. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting, because it wasn't intentional. If I had come up with something I really wanted, I would have asked him, but I didn't. And that's how he remembered it, and that's how we became friends. And I have to say this, I probably shouldn't admit this, but at least publicly, every time they had a Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita or at Del Mar, I would get Jack to call my editor and tell me he'd do an interview, but it had to be on the Friday, and it was always the Friday before the Breeders' Cup. And I got to go out there at the Globe's expense and go to the race.
Statute of limitations are probably up. Accounting probably won't.
Probably. I don't think nobody cares anymore anyway. No.
That is amazing, though. So that kind of leads me to another story. I'm going to bait you a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I love hearing about the dinner parties with Sheldon Leonard.
Oh, yeah.
And since this kind of pulls us over to Hollywood, that's a perfect segue.
Well, how that happened, it goes back a little ways. When I did get to be the first string critic, I reviewed a movie called Reuben Rubin with Tom Conti. And he plays a teacher in a small Vermont college, based on a Peter DeVries novel. And I noticed at the end credits that it was written by Julius J. Epstein. And I said, wow, that guy must be related to the guy that wrote Casablanca, one of the Epstein twins. He and his twin brother, Julie and his twin brother, Philip, wrote a lot of great movies for Warner Brothers, including, you know, Casablanca.
My favorite of all time.
Yeah, Mr. Skeffington, you know, they wrote a lot of good movies, and they improved a lot of good movies by adding dialogue and things. Anyway, they're real professionals, and they worked at Warner Brothers from like 1935 until Phil's death, and then Julie continued on as a singer. And wrote a lot of movies, but he was a great guy.
Because back then they would basically hire people, wouldn't they? You were like under contract with a studio.
That's correct. So there would be a script that they might need a few funny lines, or they need another situation, or they need something to improve it, and they'd send it over to Julie and his brother Phil, and they'd work on it and fix it up. There's several scenes in The Big Sleep, for example, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. The Raymond Chandler adaptation, that the best stuff in it was inserts that Phil and Julie put in there about, and some of them actually, the metaphors in there about horse racing and the jokes about horse racing in there were all Julie and Phil's. But anyway, so I call up the studio and find out if this guy that wrote Reuben Rubin is related to Julie. And they said, no, it's the same guy. I said, you're kidding.
Oh, wow.
You still make right movies? Yeah, so I made arrangements to go out and interview him, and I did, and we really, really, really hit it off. And in fact, when he died about 8 years later, I was in the middle of writing his autobiography or helping him go. I was ghostwriting his autobiography.
Oh, well, did they ever finish that, or you didn't have enough information?
No, there wasn't enough material to finish it. I wish there was. We never got... He unfortunately had a heart attack and a stroke over Cleveland, coming back from Boston to California. Okay. The only amusing thing about that was about a few months later, he was in the recovery. He was going through recovery in a high-end rehab place in Beverly Hills. And I went to see him, and it was during one of the Jewish holidays, and they were having a Purim play was being performed while they were feeding poor Julie, who made so much, whose wit and talents and personality were so vibrant, was now he couldn't talk much, and they had to hand feed him, so they were feeding him some gruel for lunch, and dripping down his face, and it was really humiliating. And they had a woman and a guitar player up on this little makeshift stage in the dining room. And they're putting on this play, and I'm waiting to see when Julie's going to be done so I can at least sit with him for a while. Well, Julie's this play, this incessant guitar playing for a terrible guitar player, the woman with a terrible voice, and Julie's eating, trying to eat his food, and they're forcing him to listen to the music and the thing. Anyway, in the middle of all this, in walks Walter Matthau, and Julie wrote Pete and Tilly for Walter Matthau, and they were all friends. And now, when Walter walks into a room, you know he's there. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
He makes an entrance.
Hurricane
like
just gets
Billy Wilder's still directing him. And he rushes into the room. Julie, Julie, the game's on. Syracuse and Penn State. Well, Julie went to Penn State. I got some dough on it. Come on, Julie. Hurry up, Syracuse and Penn State. So I guess that was a signal for them to stop feeding Julie. And And we wheeled him back into his room, and Walter and I and the nurse got him into his bed, and we propped him up. We turned on the TV to watch the game, and Julie turned to me, and in perfect English, like he didn't have a stroke or anything, just perfect plain English, he goes, "That's the worst play I've ever seen." And those were the last words he ever said to me. Those were the last words he ever said to me. He just sat there, and Walter was there. I mean, it was so nice of Walter to come. And it really gives you another side of Hollywood, too. Some of these people are really connected to one another.
Absolutely.
It's a small town.
As you know,
a lot of small
things, studios for quite a while. And what I noticed over time was the circle, people stay inside there because, kind of like what you were talking about with Jack, they like people that are genuine with them. And they like people who aren't grabbing at gold brickers, you know. They want people that just want to be their friend. And I think, at least my opinion, that's why there's such tight friendships, because when they do find somebody who's genuine, they really hang on to them.
Yeah, it was like a small town back then. Of course, now it's all different because they make movies differently. They make movies.
It's so global.
The whole system's different now. They don't need the big studios anymore. They're more distributors than anything else. There's a lot of differences. But I was so fortunate to be able to enter, you know, be in that world for a little while and experience it, because it was a real. It's a real pleasure, and it's not unlike being around these horses every day. It's pretty much the same
thing.
Well,
it's interesting, too, because, you know, back then there were so many references to horse racing. And I think, you know, what's always been interesting to me, if you look back at the movies and even television shows, there were so many references to Hollywood Park and Santa Anita especially, occasionally Del Mar, but mostly those two. And I always thought that was really cool. And it was, you know, you've told stories. I remember stories of, you know, Hollywood Park in the afternoon was almost like walking the back lots of the studio. You'd see so many people.
Yeah, it was amazing. Well, I, in preparation for this, I did prepare a bit, not much, but
okay.
A little. There's a really wonderful book, if people are interested, called Hollywood at the Races by a guy named Alan Shubak. Shubak. You can get it on the internet.
Okay.
Hollywood at the Races, Alan Shubak. And I was just going through it, and it talks about how Hal Roach, who was the...
Oh, yeah.
He founded... He did a lot of silent films. He put Laurel with Hardy.
He was
Hardy.
Very famous for Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah. He did the R Gang comedies and everything. You know, he's basically into low-budget comedies and shorts. But he loved racing, and he was one of the people that developed, he and Charles Struber, the two people that basically developed Santa Anita.
Oh, wow.
And then, so I was looking through this book, and I found out from 1934 to 1937, there were almost 50 movies that were about racing.
I'm not surprised.
You know, Charlie Chan at the racetrack in Old Kentucky, Down the Stretch, Three Men on a Horse, Wine, Women, and Horses. I mean, Little Miss Thoroughbred. I mean, most of these movies are gone. I probably can't even find them anymore. But it's amazing.
Bing Crosby,
because, you know,
did,
racing was so
had a
popular.
Lot of references.
Yeah.
Day at the Races.
Some of the best interviews I ever did were that, including the ones with John, were. We're at the racetrack. I remember Jack Klugman, who was very active in horse racing during the time of the Odd Couple. He and Tony Randall were doing a road show company for the Odd Couple, the Neil Simon play, and they came to town, and I got sent over to talk to Jack, and I was talking to Jack, and, you know, racing came up because it was a wonderful horse back then that he had named Jacqueline Klugman. And we started talking about that, and he found out that the same thing John Houston did. I told him, you know, well, there's racing here, you know, Suffolk Downs, we have racing, we have simulcast, you know, And so every day that he was there, I'd pick him up in the morning after they did their really read-through for the play. And I'd pick him up every day at the Colonial Theater. And Tony Randall would be there. Every day, Tony Randall would wag his finger at us and go, "Now, boys, I know where you're going, and that's not a good thing." And Jack would go there, and the people would see him at the track, and he'd sign autographs, and it was really nice. He was very nice, and he loved the horses, and he loved the gambling, and he loved the people, and people loved him. It was really nice, and that led to a good relationship too.
So how did you come to go to, you started to talk about how you came to go to the Sheldon Leonard dinners. Was that from Julie?
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for keeping it on track.
No,
I think
Dr.
that's
segue.
So after I found out about Julie Wright and Rubin, I went out to see him and we really hit it off. And the interview came out really, I thought it came out great because of Julie. He was saying great things. It was all interesting. And if it was regurgitated, nobody listened to it for the past 30 years. From then on, almost every time we went to California, to Hollywood, Diane and I would get invited to a dinner at Julie's. And it was all old Hollywood. Sheldon Leonard, as you mentioned, Sheldon Leonard was a guest. Max Schulman, Don Taylor, the actor director, and his wife, the horror queen Hazel Court, I remember very, very well. And we would just sit around, and we'd go around the table, and they'd just start telling stories, and it was such a it was just one of those really fortunate times. Everybody laughing. You know, Julie loved to tell stories about Betty Davis and how, because of the success of Casablanca, Warner Brothers allowed he and his brother to become producers, and they produced one movie, Mr. Skeffington. But they had such a hard time with Betty Davis that they never did it again. They went back to their writing, even though it didn't pay as much, as Julie pointed out. It was good because they didn't have to deal with Betty Davis anymore. Because I guess she was fairly demanding.
And the story was that they actually, as most people know, Casablanca came together relatively quickly. What people may not know is that Mr. Skeffington was the one that they put a lot of work in, and it is almost unknown today.
Yeah. Well, Casablanca is such a unique...
Exploded.
Everything
yeah.
about it. It clicked in. They didn't have a lot of time to make it. Nobody thought it was going to do any good. Then nobody had any expectations for it at all. They just, most of the actors, Ingrid Bergman, Bogey, they just wanted to get on to their next pictures.
It's so funny how down through the years, it seems like there's a lot of those stories. And I know you've talked about some of them, like Animal House, you know, Jaws. Jaws especially. I know some of the people thought that was going to be the end of their career. And that ended up being what started for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it is funny. I mean, I remember, speaking of Jaws, I remember doing an interview with Steven Spielberg when E.T. came out.
One of the ones that thought he was going to get fired.
Yeah, exactly. E.T. and Poltergeist came out the same weekend. And I made a wager with Steven Spielberg of $50 that weekend the weekend before. We had this junket up in New York and we saw E.T. and Poltergeist. And that was at a time when children's movies were relegated to the matinees and rarely played evenings. While Disney was on the verge of bankruptcy because his last few movies were only playing afternoons, he couldn't make his money back and they weren't as good as the classic ones, you know, movies like, Robin Hood those mediocre animated movies that they made before they had their great resurrection and they started to become more popular. But I told him, he asked me what I thought was going to be more successful, E.T. or Poltergeist. And I said, well, by far, E.T. E.T. is a great movie, and Poltergeist is a good movie. And he said, well, he said, I'll bet you $50. I said, okay, fine. Well, of course, you know, E.T. comes out and goes crazy. And the next time I interviewed him, which I think was for The Color Purple, he gave me the $50.
Oh, that's funny. You lived up to it. So
The
other half of that, and we kind of skimmed past it, but I'd be remiss if we didn't touch on it. So you talked about your amazing wife, Diane White. You have to tell the story about how you guys met.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I say, Diane was a prominent columnist at the Globe and a prominent
phenomenal
columnist
writer
in the city. Very good. Very funny, very witty, very biting sometimes. Martha Stewart used to read.
She was syndicated. She was all over the world.
Syndicated. Oh, yeah. She was everything. And so one year I was coming back from Saratoga, and I knew that they were going to have to. Boston Magazine did their annual survey and best lobster, best this, and they had a media page, best columnist, best TV anchor, all that stuff. So I knew this was the year I was going to get the award for best movie critic, because everybody else had left. As I mentioned before, Deke Rossell had gone out to Hollywood to work for the Directors Guild. Janet Maslin had gone to the New York Times. David Anson had gone to Newsweek. Stephen Schiff had gone to the New Yorker, along with David Denby. So I was the only one left. They had to give it to me. So I come back, and it was one of the few times I had a successful meet at Saratoga, paid for the whole vacation, and still had money left over. I went to the Harvard Square newsstand, and I got the issue of Boston Magazine. I opened it up to the media page, and it says, oh, there's Snow White, and all the rest of the columnists are just dwarfs, especially her husband, Dopey. And that's why we have all these stuffed dopeys around the house. And so that was a career high.
but I think
she was spectacular. And then the way we met was kind of interesting, because it was, as I said, I was the second screen critic. I never got to go to any of the good movies, but one time, the chief critic, Bruce McCabe, who did a wonderful job, he was sick, or he was gone someplace else, or he had something else to write about. I don't know what it was, but they sent me to this fabulous Russian movie called A Slave of Love, directed by a movie director named Nikita Mikhailkov. It's a really good movie, and it was about the making of a movie, and it was set in the period of the Russian Revolution and the transition from silent films to sound films, and all that is integrated. So I started to explain how the making of the movie and the silence, the sound was paralleling the transition from the Tsar to the Bolsheviks, went on and on and on. 4 stars, masterpiece, whatever. And that review came out on Saturday, and on Tuesday, Diane's column came out, and this is when I just knew her, really. I just knew her as a colleague, and her column started out something like, well, over the weekend, I decided to go see this movie, A Slave of Love, at the Orson Welles Cinema in Cambridge. And because the critic at this paper and others were raving about this movie. And this is a perfect example of why you should never trust movie critics. And she just laid into it. It's a terrible movie. The actor sounds like Minnie Mouse, and she just tore it apart. And so that's really how we met. I went to
Well, you have to tell the rest of the story, that you marched up there to give her a piece of your mind. And
yeah, I walked up there and gave her a piece of my mind, and I guess
took one look at her. Yeah.
Wow, this is fabulous. I got to meet Diane White because, I used to read her column long before I met her. Yeah. It's been great.
Well,
now
that
we've
kind
been
of
married.
Brings
for...
us up to you're in Boston, you and Diane, you know, Diane's working for the Globe, you're working for the Globe, and you decide you're going to take your horse racing knowledge to the next level. Tell us a little bit about how you got into horse racing. Like, I mean, I know you were always a fan, but when you decided to go take a second or a side job to learn more about it.
So, yeah. So what happened was this. We used to, my friends at the Globe, if people ever saw the Oscar-winning movie, the one that won Best Picture, called Spotlight, those all the people that have played in Spotlight was pretty much, a lot of those guys are our baseball team. We used to play like 3 days a week at lunchtime. And one by one, each one of us got hurt and couldn't play anymore. So we had to do something else. So I convinced all my pals to get together and we'd buy a racehorse. And we did. And I always thought, well, I need to know more about horses. I need to know something more about horses if I'm going to become a better handicapper. And so now that we owned one, I decided to apprentice myself out to a bottom-of-the-barrel trainer at Suffolk named Carlos Figueroa. And I did. I became
a legend.
Yeah, a legend. Yeah, he's a very interesting guy, Carlos. But he was a legend, all right. He was called the King of the Fairs because that's where he used to make all his money. He'd go to the fairs and run these $3,500 claimers, and he'd win races. And he, to give you an idea what kind of a trainer he was, he had a horse named Shannon's Hope that preceded my employment with him. And he ran Shannon's Hope 5 times in 7 days at the fairs. And he finally was approached by the ASPCA and the animal abuse lady in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And they told him that he should be advised that if he continued to do that, they were gonna arrest him. And Carlos says, "Well, let me say this.
In my defense,
you're gonna put me in jail. You have this other guy. His name is Paul Revere. He goes 20 miles over the bramble and over the stone walls and over this and over that. He comes back. He rides 22 miles. Paul Revere, and you put up a statue to him." I run this horse around the track 3 times a day for 5 days, and you're telling me you're going to put me in jail. He says, and you're going to put a statue up to Paul Revere. This is ridiculous. So he never got arrested. He talked
Well, with that kind of logic, how could you?
And the fairs were, you know, were really great for the people because they were fun and amusing and all that kind of stuff. But they were terrible, terrible for the horses. And that's how I started getting into the horse part of it, because I saw what was happening to the horses at the end of their careers, and it wasn't very pleasant. And I thought, well, you know, that was always in the back of my mind. And so when years went by, I guess I was the Globe for 20 years something, and Diane was there for 30 something. And when they offered the buyout, Diane was the first one to take it, and I was the fourth one to take it. And I came up with this idea. The Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, in their, I don't know why, but they asked me to be their operations director.
Was that still in Boston, or was that in
Kentucky? No, it was all over. They've got great offices. They've done a great job. Yeah, it's a fabulous organization. But anyway, I was their operations. They offered me this job of operations director. And I said, I said to Diane, look, we're not doing anything. Our son lives in Australia. Our parents have passed away. Let's try this. And if we don't like it, we'll just come back and we'll go someplace you want to go, or we'll come back to Boston, whatever you want. So she thought about it for a while. And 20 minutes later, she comes back and she goes, okay, I'll go with you, but only under one condition. I said, okay, what's that? She goes, that when I leave you, you won't come looking for me. I said, "Oh, yeah, that's all right." So anyway, that's how we came down here. It was the experience of Carlos, the idea that I thought that racing could do a much better job with aftercare, and that's how we ended up in Kentucky.
And prior to that, you'd actually done a little bit of rescuing up there. You have to tell the story about Little Silver Charm.
Yes. Well, so Little Silver Charm, you know, what happens? Well, let me put it this way. When you fall in love, whether you fall in love with a person or with an animal or whatever whatever you fall in love with, it's going to change your life. No matter what, that it changes your life, and that's irrevocable. So I fell in love with the horses. I really wanted to, really, really, really wanted to do something about it. And that's when we started to get involved in the aftercare, when we decided to come to Kentucky and work for the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. And out of that, I thought, well, I saw the people work, like, if you went to a ball game with Nicholson, you had to leave like 30 seconds early because it was like the Red Sea with people chasing them. And I thought, you know, they're like this around these movie stars. They were like that around Jimmy Stewart. There were a lot of people were really, really crazy about these. So he's movie star. So, and I was that way around these horses. I thought if you could do the same thing with the horses, have a place where the people could come and visit them, it might work out.
The motion picture home for horses.
We came down here, and we brought Little Silver Charm with us. And I got Little Silver Charm, who's our miniature horse, our mascot, and I think the oldest horse on the farm. I think he's about 36. We got him. And I got him because one day at Rockingham Park in New Hampshire, now defunct, and coincidentally, or I should say parenthetically rather, when I was growing up, there were 17 licensed thoroughbred tracks in New England. Now there's none, which is a stunning statistic. But one day up at Rockingham, a semi came by, and there was a banging on the outside, on the inside of this truck. And Loretta Lindemann, who was my trainer, said to the guy, the driver, "What do you got in there?" He said, "Well, I got two ducks, a goat, and a little horse." And she says, "How much do you want?" And go, $40. We came up with the $40, and we got the ducks and put them on the pond at Rockingham. We got the goat who got adopted by one of Loretta's thoroughbreds. And then when we moved to Kentucky, Di and I got Little Silver Charm and brought him down here, and he's been with us ever since. So,
and he's been a regular fixture. Actually, like you say, the mascot for old friends. And he used to be a regular fixture in Midway. Midway, Kentucky is a small town, and Little Silver Charm would stroll the streets with you.
It was great because we'd end up in the bar and there'd be like four people there, and then you'd find out the little horse was there, and there'd be like 60 or 70 people getting their picture taken at the bar with Little Silver Charm, and he didn't have to pay for his oaky Chardonnay that they fed him in a saucer, and I didn't have to pay for my beer, so it worked out really well. And he became the mascot. In fact, at one point, I found out we were in, sheriff came with a notice that I had 2 weeks to get get Little Silver Charm out of my yard at Midway. And because it was in violation of the code that said you couldn't have livestock in your yard. And I tried to explain to the gentleman who delivered this ominous news that he was a pet. He wasn't livestock, but that did no good. And it was going to end up in the courthouse. So I had to act quickly because there was no way that we were going to stay in that house if we couldn't have Little Silver Charm. So I called Penny Chenery, who had become a friend of ours, and Penny is thoroughbred knows that she owned Secretariat and was his caretaker for all those years, along with Reaver Ridge. Anyway,
Penny was also
a wonderful
part-time
woman.
Midway resident.
Yes, she this point, she lived in Lexington on Holiday Road, and she was a fabulous supporter of all friends. She was one of the few people at the beginning of this odyssey to say that Old Friends was a good idea. She was like one of the first people in the racing establishment to acknowledge that it was a good idea and it was okay to talk about aftercare. So I call her up. I go, I don't know what to do. So she says, well, I'll come over there. This is on a Friday. She came over on Sunday. We spent all day Sunday going around getting people to sign a petition to keep Little Silver Charm in the yard. And more people signed Silver Charm's petition than voted for mayor on both sides.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So, and needless to say, I got a call from somebody in the courthouse and said to me, okay, look, I'm not supposed to tell you this. I can't tell you exactly, but I think you'll be pleased by the news. I said, okay, great. And he goes, but you have to promise me one thing. I said, what's that? Don't bring the little horse to the courthouse. So I said, okay, I won't. And that was our deal. And he's been with us ever since. And he's still out here grazing and having fun. And now he's right across the pasture from Big Silvertron.
And he's had how many books written about him? Two or three?
I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
Several, yeah.
Yeah, several. Diane, my wife, wrote the great one, the one where she claims to have taken dictation from him and just wrote it down. But I have a feeling that's not exactly the truth.
It's interesting to note for people. I mean, we're joined by Michael Blowen, founder of Old Friends Farm and formerly the Boston Globe, talking about Old Friends, Hollywood, and Little Silver Charm. It's interesting to know. It would, you might know this, actually. I wonder how many different publications and TV shows he's been on.
Yeah, yeah. She's been on at least 50 TV shows.
And yeah. Probably. And everything from the Today Show to, I mean, just a laundry list of big shows.
Yeah, yeah. He's very popular. And I'll tell you, I don't know how much money he's brought here, but people come here and they get their picture taken with him, and he plays with the kids. And, you know, Rosie Napravnik, the great jockey, now retired, and her husband, trainer Joe Sharp, came here when their kids were really tiny. And Little Silver Charm was the first horse that either of those little kids got on it. So he's had his fans come here, and he really likes it. He's really into it. He likes all the attention. He really does. It's funny.
And that kind of brings this up. So it's like, you know, and that's something I think a lot of people that know you now may not realize, and you touched on it a little bit. When this first started, it wasn't instantly popular with the industry. I remember, and I don't remember the exact year that you and I met, but the way we met, I was working for a company, and I floated around, and I didn't know anything about horse racing. Still don't, but I knew less then. And I was just going around banging on doors like a door-to-door salesman. And Bob Cleveland over at Woodford Feed told me, he said, you know, you need to go meet Michael Blowen. I think he could help you. And you guys might benefit each other. And I didn't know you from Adam. And I don't know if you remember this, but I just drove in the driveway. And I'll never forget this. I don't remember the horse that was there, but it was a beautiful, big, gray horse. And I think he was pretty famous. And
Black Tie Affair.
That's what I thought, but I wasn't positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were outside with people, they were working on his legs or something. And that was how you and I met, and we just hit it off, and we've been friends ever since. But I can tell from personal experience, when you and I first met, we could part the crowd like the Red Sea. Now, I can still do that, but you don't. And it's funny how the industry in the beginning, I don't want to say they were against it, but they definitely didn't go out of their way to help it. And now it's like it's become the poster child for aftercare worldwide.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. And in retrospect, I understand their reluctance now. I didn't then. I thought
In all fairness, I do too, because there's so many times that people have maybe with good intentions, and it just ended up being a mess. So I'm sure that they were a little concerned, but it is remarkable. And I don't think, and I'm not saying this just because you're here, I honestly don't think the results would have been the same if it wasn't for you, because you've got a unique gift of skills that have really brought it to where it is.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Mark. And
I know that's with a lot of help.
A lot of help. And, you know, when you fall in love, it's a different thing. You do it 24 hours a day. It's not like dividing it up into 40-hour weeks. It's like, this is what you are. And that part of it actually makes it harder and easier at the same time. But when
piece to this is, too, your focus is always on what's best for the horse. And I think that there's something very poignant in that, in the sense that it isn't about, oh, we need to do this to achieve this goal for the farm. We need to do this to achieve this goal for our finances. It's always been the focus that this is what's best for the horse. And if we keep that focus, that will get us through. And it really has, because in the darkest of days, and it's no secret, the farm has struggled at times. You always kept your focus on the horses. And people saw that, and they realized that it wasn't anything but a love for the horse that was the reason that you did what you did.
I couldn't believe that I couldn't convince a lot of people to do that. Now, the one great example of all this, when I first started, I went to see Governor Brereton C. Jones of Airdrie Stud, who is one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. He died a few years ago, and it was devastating. But anyway, he ran a great farm and everything. So I said, well, I know what I want to do. I just don't know how to do it. So I'm going to make some appointments. I'm going to go around and talk to a couple of people, and he was one of them. And so I made an appointment to see him. I show up at his office at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we're surrounded by pictures of all of his great horses and all the great mares and all the great thoroughbreds that he has had at Airdrie and that still are there. And we sat down, and after I explained what I was going to do, he looked at me and he goes, Mike, he says, let me get this straight. You're going to get these horses, right? I go, yes, sir. And he goes, you're going to bring some of them back from Japan. Yes, sir. And he goes, but you're not going to sell them. No. And you're not going to race them. No. And you're not going to breed them. No. And he looked at me quizzically and said, what exactly are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to put them in my yard and hope people come visit. And he looked at me like I was from outer space. And then he reached into his lap drawer and he pulled out a tattered old checkbook, and he wrote Old Friends a check for $5,000, which it might have been
at that, time, those
at
are
that
huge,
point
yeah.
in the history of Old Friends, it might as well have been $1 million. And he handed it to me and he said, well, good luck to you. Good luck to you. And it was it to say, I'm going to give you this money. Don't ever come back here again.
Yeah.
Now
save it for the funeral.
Yeah. Over the years, he came to the farm. We have several of his horses that had careers at Airdrie, including Afternoon Delights, and we just got McCracken, just retired here.
Wow.
His son Brett now runs the farm and he's doing a great job. And he retired McCracken to us, and at the end, you know, Barry gave us more money and more support, and no one was more stunned that these people finally did start coming by the busload to visit all these very deserving horses who just earned every penny of having a suitable retirement. And that was a good showcase for the horse racing people to be able to show people that we take care of these horses in their dotage. And it's worked out way beyond my wildest expectations. It's just taken a lot longer than I thought.
And I think that brings us to a really good point. And we're kind of up against the hour, so we're going to have to wrap up here, which I hate to do. We're going to have to do this again. But one of the things that's interesting to me is that Old Friends continues to grow. continues to outdo itself and has actually benefited the industry in multiple ways now beyond just giving these amazing athletes a place to retire. It's become the largest group of aging thoroughbreds in the world, which has benefited equine medicine in countless ways. It's benefited farrier schools. You know, I know veterinarian schools use Bold Friends continuously. It's been something that has, there's the list of educational purposes that have come out of Bold Friends is amazing. And I mean, everything, much more than people would normally think, everything from photography, journalism, you know, farrier schools, veterinarian schools, you know, equine management. It's pretty remarkable the benefits that this farm has provided beyond the benefit of giving these old horses and retired athletes, you know, home that's deserving.
Yeah, I would concur with that. In fact, the shoeing school is here today. The Kentucky Shoeing School is here today. They do all our trims and do all our feet. They come every 6 weeks, make sure the horses' feet are okay.
And I think there's no bigger success story to that than your farm manager, Antonio.
Yeah.
He was a
graduate. Yeah. Antonio's learned everything. Now he runs everything. He went to blacksmith school, so... You know, and the other thing is, you know, the other thing that's good for the horses, everybody's around these horses all the time. So, in fact, half of the people that work here live here and houses around on the farm so that no little, even a little nick doesn't go unnoticed for very long. And sure. We're only 14 minutes from Rude and Riddle, so any time we have a crisis, they're right there to help us immediately. And the sooner you get to those things, the better off everybody is. And you know, we lucked into some of this stuff. We earned some of this stuff. And I told Diane when we moved here from Boston, I said, well, we're going to die, I said, but like everybody else. But there's two things I think we're not going to die of. And she goes, what's that? And I said, shoveling snow and boredom. And so far, that's true.
It's held true. It's held true. And, it is remarkable. I would go one step further, though. It's amazing to me how many times you see good luck and fortune follow a lot of hard work. And I was there to see a lot of your hard work, not all of it, but I know it hasn't been easy. I know it's been a labor of love, but I also know it hasn't been easy.
Yeah. You do know, Mark, and I appreciate your help with all kinds of things, with the fence and your friendship and you're advocating for old friends. It's meant a lot to us. It's meant a lot to the horses. It really has, and I appreciate it.
Well, and I appreciate you guys. I mean, it's been an amazing friendship from the beginning, and I really enjoy you a lot. I think of you as family. Dan as well. So we're up against the hour here. I hate to say it, but we're going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. This has been Michael Blowen from Old Friends Farm, former Boston Globe entertainment writer. We really appreciate it. I really hope you'll come back and do another show with us. We are brought to you today by King Umberto's in New York. If you're ever in New York, you have to go to King Umberto's. The Palm, if you're in Miami, don't forget to take a moment and look at oldfriendsequine.org. If you're anywhere within 2 hours of Lexington, you owe it to yourself to go take a tour. Go to the farm, take a tour. You'll be happy you did. Michael has a standing policy that if anybody isn't happy, he'll give them their money back, and I don't think he's ever given a refund. So we highly recommend you go and see it, and you have to say hi to Game On Dude for us. My favorite horse of all time. I will tell you, and you kind of touched on this, Michael, I'm kind of like you. I don't get starstruck very easy. I've met a lot of celebrities. I don't know. I mean, you stood next to me when I met Joe Torian. I didn't even know who he was. The thing that I have always kind of been amazed with is horses. And I will never forget the day that Game On Dude came. I'll never forget the day you told me Game On Dude was coming. And that was interesting to me because he was a horse that I followed in I was working in California when he was big. And I can't say that I was a big horse racing fan. I had gone a few times, more for the entertainment than anything. And I didn't really know the sport, still don't, as far as handicapping or anything like that. But his name caught your attention. He was in the news a lot out there because he was so big. He won so often. And it was one of those ones that his name stood out. And, you know, mutual friend of ours, Bob Baffert, he was his trainer. And, you know, Bob always kind of stood out to the media. So when he was coming to Old Friends, that was kind of, I don't think I would have been much more taken back if somebody told me Elvis was stopping. it was kind of that level. And I remember the day he walked off the trailer, and it was almost surreal. So I do understand what you're saying. It's like there's something about them that's just, you know, captivating and magnetic. And I would encourage anybody, if you have an opportunity to go see Old Friends, you owe it to yourself to go. It's a tremendous organization. But beyond that, it has to be one of the best places to take a tour and really get to see the industry. And not just the horses. You get to see some of the memorabilia. They have a beautiful event barn there now. You can actually do events there. There's a lot of things that the farm does. They have a lot of events throughout the year. Take a moment. Take a look. OldFriendsEquine.org. Our other foundation that we support here is No Fallen Heroes. Please take a moment and take a look at these people. We're losing over 53 vets every day to suicide. And we have to put a stop to that. So anything that we can do to help these people. And No Fallen Heroes is run by a vet for vets. And the other thing that they do that's unique is that they help the families and first responders. So it's not just veterans that need some help. If your company's in need of help with their health care, please take a look at mbgrayhealthcare.com. She is the best of the best when it comes to healthcare consulting. This has been Hollywood and Horsepower. We've been joined by Michael Blowen, who is gracious enough to spend some time with us today. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you guys again next week. Thanks, everybody.